The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, who owns your brain scan? We talk to neuroscientists about how much they'll soon be able to tell from reading your brain, and listen in on a play that examines some of the ethics around the coming technology.
What's so expensive? Not the sequencing. Send it to China. They'll email it back in a week. It's the research companies. They've got their patent protection. You want to test for their genes, you need to pay them a fee. That's what we're paying for. You too.
If you care about our environment and want to do your level best to fight climate change, which of the political parties deserves your vote? The Guardian held its own green hustings last week with the three men who want to be your next climate change minister. We bring you our analysis of which party is the most green.
I honestly don't see how going forward you plug that gap in a sustainable way. And I looked on the website when you did your calculation today for the Guardian about your plans. I just don't see how you fill the gap.
The key reason we can meet our targets is by reducing the amount of energy UK PLC uses.
And volcano dust. How much is too much for our aircraft?
This was a volcano next to a significant landmass that hadn't erupted during the history of civil flying, and therefore nobody had actually thought about doing the numbers and coming up with an action plan in case something went wrong.
All that, plus a new recreational drug to replace mephedrone, why brain training games might be a waste of time, and a horde of new creatures discovered in Borneo. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome everyone. After several weeks away, I'm sorry to tell all of Nell's rapidly growing horde of fans that I'm back. Nell herself is going to take a break this week, and in the studio today is someone who really should be in Washington. It's Robin McKee, science editor of The Observer. Robin, why are you here?
I was going to interview E.O. Wilson.
Well, you'd much rather do this though, right?
I'm really happy to be here.
Instead of meeting a legendary entomologist.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, hopefully this will live up to your expectations. Our other guests this week are two neuroscientists and a playwright. No, it's not the start of a joke. They're here to talk about Interior Traces, a play that examines the science and ethics of brain scanning. The technology to delve deeper into the workings of the brain is continually getting more sophisticated. Doctors can already image the brain to find damage and even watch it in action as a person thinks or hears a song. In future, brain scanners might be routinely used to diagnose diseases before they show up any symptoms, and perhaps even predict behaviour. Here's a clip from a performance of Interior Traces.
11 years I've been doing it. Sign in at the desk, metal detector, buzzed by security, upstairs to Alicia's office. Half my life. First with mum, then on my own. When I turned 18, that's when it turned a bit rough. When they told me I had to keep coming. And last month, this guy in an old style suit comes up to me outside the clinic. He's doing a report
about people who are discriminated against by this legislation. Like you, having to have these tests every 6 months.
A report for a civil liberties campaign, he said. Some kind of political thing called
the Humanity Alliance.
Never heard of it, mate. I'm not interested, I tell him.
Why don't you take my card anyway, in case you change your mind? I'm Robert, by the way. And if you need anything, even just a chat or legal advice, we can help you out.
James Wilkes and Louise Whiteley wrote the play, and they're both here. Louise, can you just go through to us what we just heard?
Sure. So what you heard there was one of the episodes of the play set in the future. And in that episode, a character called Mike is diagnosed in childhood as being likely to develop psychopathy, so likely to become a violent criminal, in essence. And he gets tied into a program of preventative treatment as a child. And when he hits the age of 18, he suddenly realises that his society has defined him on the basis of something that hasn't actually happened yet. He hasn't committed a crime. And he tries to escape from this in his personal life by getting involved with a political organisation who's challenging the way that the government's integrated neuroscience into our legal system.
So this is a bit like pre-crime or something, Minority
yeah.
Report sort of stuff. So this is actually something that potentially might even happen. It's not completely beyond the bounds of possibility.
No, not at all. Already researchers looking into antisocial behaviour disorders in childhood are starting to develop training programmes, and we are going to come up against these questions of how long this goes on into people's lives, and also what effects it has on children of being diagnosed and defined in these ways, which isn't that far away from contemporary issues about, for example, attention deficit disorder being medicated with Ritalin.
James, do you want to just take us through a bit of the story as well? So sure. Louise mentioned what we just heard, but then generally, how does the story pan out?
We're looking at two characters. One is this young man with psychopathy. The other is a middle-aged woman who develops a brain tumour. So we're looking at the ways in which these new ways of looking at the brain have all sorts of social, ethical and legal implications. And the way we did that was by taking these two characters and by setting them in three different eras, in the past, in the present, and in the episode we just heard, in the year 2030. So we're imagining how different societies and different eras might legislate and might think differently about who we are and about who we might become, according to the different technologies that they have, the different abilities to see inside the brain.
What led you to sort of get involved in this project?
Well, we both were interested in these issues from studying psychology and philosophy. I then went off in a sort of different path and started writing plays and poetry. And Louise and I thought this would be a really good way to kind of bring our interests together. And I think fiction is a really interesting way of approaching these kind of issues, to try and dramatise these ideas, these problems.
Our third guest this week is Geraint Rees, who is the scientific consultant for the play, and he's a neuroscientist at University College London. Geraint, just take us through what the technology is capable of now, brain scanning-wise. What can we do now, and what will be possible in the near future?
There are two main things we can do with brain scanning at the moment. One is to look at the structure of the brain, and that's often used in neurological disorders, where you want to diagnose what's wrong, and increasingly that's used in some neurological disorders to try and anticipate, for example, Alzheimer's disease. Can we see thinning of the brain before symptoms emerge? The other technology is the same MRI scanners, magnetic resonance imaging, but now used to look at the function of the brain, how it lights up when we think, feel, and make actions. And that's used by scientific researchers to try and understand the basic workings of the brain and how that goes wrong after disease. But increasingly, people are also interested in the idea about whether it can be used in the sort of context explored in these plays.
And so some of these scenarios that the play goes through, this idea of, as Louise talks about, this pre-crime type idea, I mean, how fanciful or realistic is that?
As Louise said, it's not entirely fanciful because, of course, we already have debates in society about people with personality disorders or things that are considered untreatable and how we should treat individuals like that. So it's not entirely fanciful to think in future that we will be able to detect or delineate things, not necessarily to do with the brain, perhaps to do with behaviour early in development, early in people's lives, that may predispose to something later in their life. And there's an important question then about what you do about that and about what you consider normal.
But and where is the technology heading? I mean, things like, as you said, functional magnetic resonance imaging, something that has really taken off in the last decade or so. In another decade or two decades, is that technology going to be even better? Or are there going to be new things that we'll be able to do to actually look at what people are thinking or look at the structure of the brain?
Yes, it's going to get a lot better, I think, in terms of the spatial resolution, how fine the detail is we can resolve with these scanners. That's improved over time. But it's also important to put it in context. It's still incredibly difficult to use these scanners to, say, read people's thoughts. You can't do that at the moment. Maybe in a very carefully controlled experimental setting where I'm asking you to look at or think of one of two possibilities, then I can, in that very carefully controlled situation, make a prediction that's quite accurate about which one you're thinking from your brain scan. But that's a long way from what we might imagine in science fiction of actually reading people's thoughts.
So perhaps the issue which is most present in terms of society's discussions of these dilemmas is bringing brain scans into court. So for example, in one of the episodes of the play, we look at whether fMRI might be used to show that someone was lying versus telling the truth. And there's been a fair amount of coverage about this in the mainstream as well as the scientific press. And what we wanted to do in that episode of the play was not just to say, how accurate is it and is it ever going to be 100%? Because it's not going to be 100%. Even if it gets super accurate, approaching 100%, what do we want to do about it? Do we want to use it in court?
Robin.
It strikes me there's a sort of a parallel here between the kind of testing that you're doing, talking about in the play, and also the testing that began, say, 20 years ago using DNA technology. What is the point, what is the ethical issue, or what is the moral background behind diagnosing somebody with a condition, either by genes or by brain test, but when that condition is untreatable? And if you're talking about somebody with a psychopathic disorder that you clearly can't treat, then what is the ethics actually of diagnosing that? Strikes me as an extremely interesting philosophical notion. But
yeah, I think that was a real concern for us in writing the play. And one of the things we wanted to try and draw out was exactly that question of what does it mean to diagnose? We're also interested in trying to give body to these arguments. So rather than just have a polemic on one side or another, was to actually create characters who would, you know, the essence of drama being that kind of argument,
yes.
And being that debate. And it's a really rich topic in that sense, and as well as an important one.
Okay, well, let's listen to another clip from the play. Here the characters are discussing the politics of collecting genetic information.
Life doesn't always deal us a fair hand, Katie. That's just one of the rules of genetics, variation. But we can equalise it a bit. Level the playing field.
You believe that? My national insurance is doubling next month because I missed one scan. I don't call that a levelling.
I know you're upset.
Well, what's so expensive? Not the sequencing. Send it to China. They'll email it back in a week. It's the research companies. They've got their patent protection. You want to test for their genes, you need to pay them a fee. That's what we're paying for. You too.
Look, these companies need to fund their research. They're doing important work. Scientists can't go back to their ivory towers. They're helping people.
Consumers?
Consumers, if you like. But the market isn't some force of evil. All the important advances are happening in commercial companies today, whether you like it or not. And the health service needs to harness that.
And it does it by recruiting as many patients as possible. I'm sorry, but that's what it's all about, isn't it? Each hospital collecting all the genomes it can, all the bio information, so they've got something to put on the table, something to contribute.
James, it was quite clear what was going on there, but who were those characters?
The first person to speak was the genetics counsellor, and the second person was Katie, the character. She's enrolled on this programme voluntarily as a student of genetic testing, health testing, and then she finds herself on this treadmill that she can't get out of. They find that she has a susceptibility or propensity to brain cancers, and she's put on this series of preventative scans or scans which aim to diagnose the condition before it gets too serious. And we're interested in the kind of emotional impact this might have on someone if you were to be drawn into this system of potentially always being ill in a way. So I think we're interested in the emotional context there, and of course the political implications of that information, how it gets disseminated, who controls it, where it's at. I mean, data is a huge issue even now, so we're kind of just imagining 20 years in the future.
I mean, if you imagine that this sort of brain scans are available in 20 years and they can help people diagnose major diseases or psychological conditions or any of these things, it is slightly worrying to think that someone, maybe the state, would own this information and, you know, as you say, put you in prison beforehand, or maybe use it in court against you. Who should own all of this stuff?
I think in general the individual should own the information, because the information comes from the individual, and we live in a country where liberty is one of the sort of cornerstones of the British unwritten constitution. That said, there is the question of how you decide how you share that information with other people.
These questions aren't entirely new. We always already have issues about who owns information on your genetic scan or your medical testing. And as well as the futuristic scenarios where we imagine quite an extreme case where you might have a mapping of all the health conditions you might develop in the future, whether you might become a psychopath, whether you might have a particular kind of personality. We're also interested in the smaller questions, like what happens if you're given a brain scan in a doctor's office which seems to show a tumour and they send you home with it? How does that make people feel differently about whether their selves are their brains?
The play Interior Traces will be touring the UK, appearing first at the Salisbury Arts Centre on the 5th of May. There's more information on all of this at www.theidentityproject.org.uk.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jar.
The UK is currently gripped by election fever. Politicians are crisscrossing the country in a bid to become your next government in one of the most tightly contested races for decades. One of the issues that the three main parties seem to broadly agree on is the need for action on climate change. So last week, The Guardian got the climate spokesman of these parties to debate some of the finer points of what they might push for, environmentally speaking, in the government. Simon Hughes spoke for the Liberal Democrats, Greg Clark for the Conservatives, but the first person you're about to hear is Labour's Ed Miliband, who's been holding the climate change job in government for the past few years.
I've been the Secretary of State since October 2008, and in that time we have taken a number of steps, of ambitious steps on climate change, including banning new dirty coal power stations. We've become the world leader in offshore wind. We've introduced feed-in tariffs. But I'm under no illusions about the scale of the task that greets us in the next Parliament. And I think the central election question is, how do we widen the circle of the committed on climate change?
5 years ago, we couldn't have had this debate. When David Cameron was elected leader of the Conservative Party, for the first time you had a leader of a party who was putting climate change right shop front, right at the beginning, and we've continued that right throughout the last 5 years, and it's reflected now in our manifesto.
Liberal Democrats have understood for years that environment and climate change issues touch every part of our lives and every part of government policy. We won't be able to recover from our economic difficulties if we continue to rely on finite resources and we waste much of what we have available to us. Moving towards a new and renewable economy will be the only way to create new jobs and return to sustainable growth.
I'd like to start with a question from someone who promisingly goes by the name of Junk Mail. What do the parties think of the recent New Economic Foundation report that suggests that expanding Heathrow will result in a £5 billion loss to the UK?
We've been very clear that we're against the third runway at Heathrow. I think the approach to predict and provide is not going to get us into a position of meeting our climate change objectives. I think it's a failure of imagination just to think that there aren't better alternatives. I mean, who of us would choose to fly short distances when there is a train that can whisk you from city centre to city centre? So I think we need to invest and catch up with other countries by having a functioning high-speed rail network across this country linked into the continent that can then reduce the demand for slots at Heathrow. It's better for everyone, it's better experience, and it's better for our carbon footprint.
On the issue of Heathrow, that can fit within that framework, but we've said that only 50% of the slots on the third runway can go ahead, the other 50% subject to that target. What Greg didn't tell you is that he's in favour of airport expansion in the southeast. He just won't tell you which airport he wants it to happen at.
Simon. Ed is right to say that this shouldn't be looked at as a one airport issue, and we have to stop the tax system, which means there's an incentive to fly with half-empty planes, and tax on the planes that fly rather than the passengers that fly.
Academic research has shown that for the UK to meet the emissions reductions targets implied by the 2008 Climate Change Act would require an effort the equivalent of 30 new nuclear power plants by 2015.
We've shown sector by sector how we will meet our commitments on climate change to 2020, which is for a 34% reduction in emissions. We've already got about a 20%. We have to embrace all the low-carbon alternatives at our disposal and nuclear power.
Simon.
It's a major difference of policy between us on the one hand and the Labour and Tory parties on the other. We don't believe that nuclear power is the solution. We're not going to be able to deliver power from a new second generation of nuclear power stations in time to deal with the crisis that we're told is coming in the middle of the next decade.
I think we do need investment in nuclear. The shame is that we had this gap between the end of the current fleet of nuclear power plants and the earliest date at which new ones can open. But I do think we need it.
I do want to come back to Simon, though, because I honestly don't see how going forward you plug that gap in a sustainable way. And I looked on the website when you did your calculation today for the Guardian about your plans. I just don't see how you fill the gap.
The key reason we can meet our targets is by reducing the amount of energy UK PLC uses.
Simon Hughes there for the Liberal Democrats, Greg Clark for the Conservatives, and Ed Miliband from Labour. You can hear a much longer version of that debate, if you really want to, at environmentguardian.co.uk. And to discuss some of the highlights of that clip, though, we've got James Randerson, who edits that website. James, welcome.
Hello.
What you were live tweeting that debate. Was it exciting?
It was. I mean, this was the debate that Sky and Fox News and BBC all wanted to have. So it was very good that we had it. And it was a very serious debate. And in many ways, Greg Clark was most sort of vulnerable on the question of how many climate sceptics there are in his party and, perhaps even outright climate deniers, if you want to use that phrase. Also on wind turbines, both Simon Hughes and Ed Miliband attacked Greg Clark for the fact that lots of Tory councils, although the Tory leadership talks the talk on renewable energy, when it comes to actually making them happen on the ground, Tory councils tend to block them. But Greg Clark's response was, well, we've got loads of councils and they tend to be in rural areas, which is where these planning applications come up.
Robin, is there anything there from the climate policies of the three parties that sort of irks you or makes you sort of raise an eye?
The Tories, how many MPs are actually flat deniers? And I use the term denier and not sceptic. Scientist is a sceptic, and somebody who opposes climate change or doesn't believe in it is a denier. And I strongly suspect that about half the Tory MPs are secret deniers and are just keeping their mouth shut.
Some of them are not election. So secret. Peter Lilly, for example, seems to not really think that it's an issue.
Some are not secret, and I think that's actually a really key issue for the
I mean, how big is that an issue for them, though, James?
I think it's very big. I mean, because it means that despite all of the PR that David Cameron has done on this issue in order to sort of create this kind of blue-green image, which brings to mind algae to me, but anyway, this blue-green image, underneath it all, he's got a grassroots who are very sceptical to all of this stuff. I mean, Tim Montgomery, influential Tory blogger, reckons there are 6 deniers, stroke sceptics, stroke contrarians in the cabinet, which is going to make it very difficult if Cameron forms a government to really go forward on this issue, one would imagine.
The other thing I noticed listening to that debate was that Greg Clark talks about, and the Tories talk about, you don't need more regulation to tackle some of this stuff. You don't need more business regulation. I just wonder if that's a sensible sort of sensible direction to go in, given that we clearly need more regulation, targets, that kind of thing.
This came out actually on Wednesday. We launched this sort of interactive online national carbon calculator, which I urge you all to go and play with because it's really good fun. It's basically it's a kind of model of the UK economy and energy system, and you move the dials, move the sliders to kind of increase the number of nuclear power stations or whatever it is you want to do. And we invited all the parties to have a play with it and then write about their sort of vision for the UK energy infrastructure. The Lib Dems did just that. They had a few things to say about, you know, you haven't included that, you haven't included this. But both Tory and Labour refused to use the calculator and set down what their vision was. And the Tories gave the most sort of coherent reason for this, and it speaks to your question, which is that they said, we don't agree with some kind of command and control economy. We say, set the framework and let the market decide. But, you know, they don't appear to have a sort of vision of the direction of travel, or at least if they do, they weren't prepared to articulate it.
And also, several studies have shown that actually that the market won't produce renewables quickly enough to actually produce the carbon cuts you need. There's more discussion of all of this stuff on the Guardian's environment website, including quite a positive piece by George Monbiot saying that actually the climate change debate seems to have grown up. Okay, well, all of that, as I said, environmentguardian.co.uk. Let's have a look now at some of the other science stories around this week. News Jam.
Playing brain training computer games will not make you cleverer. That's the conclusion of a major trial of the software carried out by British neuroscientists in collaboration with the BBC Lab UK website. Volunteers were asked to practice a series of online tasks for a minimum of 10 minutes a day, 3 times a week, for 6 weeks. More than 11,000 people aged from 18 to 60 took part, and although they improved on the tasks in the games, scientists found no boost in performance when measuring general cognitive abilities such as memory, reasoning and learning.
The government should ban the use of manufactured trans fats from all foods sold in the UK. Doctors say that the move could save thousands of lives a year. Trans fats are a big risk factor for heart disease. They're used when making deep-fried food, margarine and baked goods such as cakes and biscuits. Even a tiny reduction in the amount of food energy they represent in an average person's diet would have huge health benefits, according to researchers at the Harvard Medical School.
A synthetic chemical known as MDAI has already emerged as a successor to the recreational drug known as methadone, which was banned in Britain last week after becoming the 4th most popular drug in Britain behind cannabis, cocaine and ecstasy. The new drug was identified by analysts at King's College London who monitor the internet for new trends in drug abuse. MDAI replicates many of the effects of ecstasy and was developed as an antidepressant in the US during the 1990s. Experts believe its chemical blueprint could soon be mass-produced by the Chinese manufacturers who have previously flooded the UK with methadone.
And finally, conservationists have found a treasure trove of weird animals in Borneo. They include an enormous stick insect, more than half a metre long, and a bizarre lungless frog. the weird and wonderful creatures were discovered thanks to a pioneering deal between three governments to protect and conserve 220,000 square kilometres of lush rainforest on the island. Around 120 new species were recorded in the protected region known as the Heart of Borneo. Other creatures include a vivid, flame-coloured, bronze-back snake that can flare the back of its neck to reveal bright orange colours when threatened, a new bird named the spectacled flower pecker, and a green and yellow slug with a tail three times the length of its head.
Brain training. Robin, were you surprised by the results of this?
No, not the slightest bit. No, but then I'm cynical. I mean, I've been doing Sudoku for 5 years and it hasn't stopped my degeneration.
Are you better at Sudoku at least?
No, I'm still crap at Sudoku.
You need some other types of help, don't you? Louise, Geraint, what do you make of this? I mean,
well, we already know some forms of brain training work. For example, at primary school, people learn to read. That's an example of brain training delivered by teachers that results in a general skill that enables us to do all sorts of amazing things. So clearly some types of brain training work. This study is very interesting because of its size, and that's the strength. But it's very weak because the length of brain training that these individuals actually engage in is something like 10 minutes over a three-week period, about 4 hours in total. And you can imagine if we tried to learn to read for 4 hours, we might not get very far.
One of the things I find really interesting about this story and the debate surrounding it is this question of transfer. So if you do something in a lab, does it transfer to real life? Does brain training make you clever and intelligent in every other way? And in quite a different way, we looked at that in Interior Traces as well, which is the question of if you do something in a scanner, what relevance does it have to the real world analogue of what you're doing in the scanner? So, for example, if you look at a painting and you're asked to rate its beauty, does that really show us aesthetics in the brain? So I think this question of transfer from experiment to real life is a really big, big one for neuroscience.
Transfer is critical, obviously, because If you think about it, if we wanted to learn to play the trumpet, would we intuitively think that going off and playing a lot of chess would help us with that? Well, probably not. But on the other hand, if we were thinking about general reasoning skills and things like that, would learning to play chess help us with that? Well, perhaps. So just intuitively, before we even get to the science, certain things we think might be useful for transfer and certain things might not.
If you were doing a study again and you wanted to check whether brain training is actually useful, because I think that it doesn't prove that brain training is not a good thing to do, what would you do?
The strength of this study, as I said, is they've taken almost 12,000 people, and all hats off to the team that did this, because that's a major undertaking. But I think at the end of the day, it's what we call a null result. And scientists are always saying absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. You can't prove that something doesn't exist. So if you were doing it again, what you'd want to do is try and correct those issues that have been talked about by us and in the press. Like, you would ideally want to have 12,000 people trained over a very long period of time. Some people, like Malcolm Gladwell, would say you need 10,000 hours
this is
to
his
become
idea.
An expert at something.
To become an expert in a craft, you need 10,000 hours, and that's, what, 10 years of full-time activity, essentially. So, yeah, that's going to be a tough study.
I think that's tough. That's asking for a lot.
Okay, well, we'll leave that stuff there. We can read all of those news stories on the website, guardian.co.uk/science. But we're not going to leave the news completely without talking about the Icelandic volcano that grounded all flights over the UK for almost a week.
I took the view at the beginning of this that a blanket closure of airspace was not necessary. My personal belief is that we could have safely continued operating for a period of time. I think there were occasions when...
We've been flying through ash, the remnants of volcanic ash, for years. I mean, along the edge of Java, which is where my volcano was that I got involved with, there are about 92 volcanoes, of which 6 or 7 are active at any one time.
It's embarrassing, and it's a European mess.
One of the questions bugging airlines now is, why were the government authorities so unsure about what the safe level of volcanic ash was for planes? Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample spoke to an aeronautical engineer, Chris Yates, to find out.
In the past, we've seen quite a number of instances of aircraft flying into volcanic ash cloud. In 80 or so incidents, we've seen significant damage done to airframes and also to aero engines. Damage ranging from serious abrasion of the windscreens on the cockpit to the stripping of paint from aeroplanes, and right down to, in the worst case scenarios, aircraft engines actually shutting down, the aircraft actually becoming a glider.
So what has changed that means the airspace over Britain at least is now open again?
Well, I think there are two significant points to make here. One of those is the position of the ash cloud itself as it was being emitted from the volcano and coming down over Europe. The rules, the regulations governing this are formulated by ICAO, and those rules state that wherever an ash cloud exists over a significant landmass where there are airports, then planes are grounded and airspace must close. But the highest concentration levels of the ash emitted from Iceland were in actual fact over, for the most part, the northern coast of Scotland specifically, and more often than not, just off that coast. So it stands to reason, I think, if we apply some common sense here, that the further away you move from the core content of that ash cloud, the less concentration there is of potentially damaging particles within it.
But there's also been some work by the manufacturers and also by the Civil Aviation Authority to look at a safe level, which seems to have been reached rather rapidly.
But not as rapidly as you might imagine. Since this volcano erupted last week, an awful lot of work has been done to assess whether it is safe or otherwise to fly. Not least of which are the test flights that both the Met Office and the Civil Aviation Authority have conducted, the measurements that they've conducted in the upper atmosphere. And latterly, the test flights carried out by a number of European carriers. All of that information fed into the collective thinking. And then the aero engine manufacturers asked to reassess whether their equipment on board aircraft would be susceptible to damage, given what we knew about the concentration levels of ash in the upper atmosphere where we needed to fly at the time. So all of that number crunching done, and the manufacturers came back with an answer saying it's probably time that we reassessed the regulation grounding flights within Europe.
Why wasn't that kind of testing done before as perhaps part of a kind of, you know, emergency planning strategy for the air industry?
One would like to think that we have some form of emergency planning, crisis management plan in place for these sorts of eventualities, and quite clearly we did not. This sort of thing has never happened before over a significant landmass such as the UK and Europe. And therefore, I suspect that nobody actually thought about it. You know, the available evidence that we had to go on was gathered mostly from incidents involving aircraft around the Pacific Rim, the so-called ring of fire of volcanic activity. And, you know, in those parts of the world nowadays, when a volcano goes off, then air traffic is redirected around the affected area until such a time as it becomes clear again. This was a volcano next to a significant landmass that hadn't erupted during the history of civil flying, and therefore nobody had actually thought about doing the numbers and coming up with an action plan in case something went wrong.
Chris Yates there speaking with The Guardian's Ian Sample. It wasn't just Robin affected by the volcano. Louise, you managed to get here despite the volcano. Tell us about your massive journey.
Well, my massive journey was largely self-inflicted, given that I was snowboarding in British Columbia and was trying to make my way back from there. I was lucky enough to make it on only the second flight to the UK out of Toronto as scheduled in my seat.
That's lucky. That's not so bad. I mean, just this, you know, all of this obviously tells us is never go anywhere further than a ferry ride away or a car drive.
Yes,
planes are terrible for many reasons other than climate change. Okay, well, for all other volcano related news, you can go to guardian.co.uk/Iceland-volcano. For the rest of the science news, just go to guardian.co.uk/science. You can leave your thoughts on anything you've heard today at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. You can also subscribe to this podcast while you're there. We've got Facebook pages and Twitter feeds too, if you're into those sorts of things. That's it for this week's show. Thanks to Robin McKee and James Randerson, and also our guests, James Wilkes, Louise Whiteley and Geraint Rees. This podcast was produced by Tim Mabey. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.